Morning, everyone. 8:06 on your Friday morning. It's September 10th. I'm Sean Higgins in the KPCW studios in Park City, looking at about 55 degrees here in Old Town, 48 down in Heber. But on the line with me now with a full weekend forecast, we have ABC4 meteorologist Thomas Gaboy. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning and good Friday to you. As we go through today, again, we're continuing to see changes in our weather. We're going to get more times of patchy smoke, but you're going to notice less of it here in the next couple of days, and that's aided by a southwesterly flow, and that southwesterly flow is also helping bring in moisture. You're going to notice a few more clouds around today as well. And from this afternoon, we'll start to introduce a slight chance for isolated showers and thunderstorms. And from the afternoon into tonight, there'll be about a 1 in 3 chance that wet weather could find you. So if you have any plans this afternoon or for tonight, maybe going to a high school football game or you have dinner plans, you might want to keep the umbrella handy just in case, as isolated showers and thunderstorms will be a possibility even through tonight. We could see the rain chance pick up a little bit as we go through the overnight hours into tomorrow. But for daytime highs, it's still going to be a warm one, with Park City getting into the lower 80s. Overnight lows tonight will be dropping into the middle 50s. Tomorrow, as that system really works its way through, we'll also see some slightly cooler temperatures. The daytime high for our Saturday, around 74 degrees, and about a 2 in 3 chance that wet weather finds you. And it looks like tomorrow, the best chance of rain for a shower or thunderstorm is going to come during the early part of the day and then afternoon as well. So maybe a little bit quieter through mid-morning, but still at least keeping a chance there. For your Saturday nights, we'll start to dry things back out, keeping an isolated storm chance through around 6, 7 o'clock, and then we'll be looking at a partly cloudy to mostly clear night as temperatures drop into the lower and middle 50s. On your Sunday, mostly sunny most of the day with temperatures climbing to the middle 70s, but another wave of energy will be coming in from the west, and that could lead to a slight chance of rain for the second half of the day on Sunday, about a 10% chance, leading to about a 1 in 3 chance heading into Sunday night with temperatures dropping into the middle 50s. By Monday, we really start to kind of dry things back out, so any rain looks like it's going to be done by the time we get to the second half of the day on Monday, temperatures still being in the middle 70s for daytime highs. And then Tuesday through Thursday of next week, daytime highs low to mid 70s, very seasonal for this time of year, and overnight lows will be in the upper 40s and lower 50s.
Thomas, thank you so much and enjoy your weekend.
Likewise.
On the line with me now, I have Matt Wagner with Basin Recreation with this week's Mountain Trail Report. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Sean.
All right, so I hear there's quite a bit coming up on the schedule. We have Tour de Suds on Sunday from Park City to Guardsman's Pass. Can you give us a little info on that?
Yeah, so I just talked to Rick from Mountain Trails this morning, and he just wanted me to remind everybody to register early, and they are close to selling out. So see more details on the Mountain Trails Foundation website. They'll be starting about 10 a.m., so if you'd like to avoid the area, that's about the time. They're starting at the city park and going up to Guardsman Pass.
Awesome. And then we also have some Summit Park Trail closures. Still closed for forestry work up there. When will we see those open again?
Yeah, I was hoping to get them open either today or tomorrow after some cleanup work. But at the very latest, we're looking at early next week, Monday or Tuesday, getting those trails opened up again. The best, most up-to-date information you're going to be able to find is linked from basinrecreation.org, our website. If you go to the news section, there's a link to the project website, and that has a map and all the up-to-date information. You also can keep an eye out on our social media page, and that'll tell you as soon as we can, we'll get those trails back open.
And I see still some construction happening up at the Discovery Ridge Trailhead. What is going on up there?
Yeah, so construction is drawing to a close. We're very excited that it's almost done. But, you know, we just got a request that everybody keep the area clear for now. I know it's tempting since Summit Park trails are closed to go down to Discovery Ridge and use some of those new trails we've got. But please just keep the area clear so we can finish up the work, and then we will absolutely let everybody know as soon as that trailhead is open and available for use.
Also, some more construction going on at the Trailside Bike Park Jump Line. I understand most of it will be open, but people should keep an eye out for partial closures on the Jump Line, Pump Track, and Skills area. What exactly will be closed, and what will be open to the public over there?
Yeah, so the project is to replace the jump line, so that's going to be certainly under construction. And in that same area, we're going to be building a dual slalom feature. And it has affected the Skills Park area, so some of those wooden features for building skills and balance have been removed already, but that whole area is going to be under construction, so just keep an eye out. Most of the bike park will be open from top to bottom. We've still got our our downhill lines open, but just avoid the pump track, jump line, skills park area.
Gotcha. Point to point was last weekend. How did that go? Was that a success?
Yeah, I think it was great. The report that I got from our trails patroller was that very low impact to the trails and no complaints.
Sounds great, Matt. Thank you so much. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Sean.
Polville mayoral candidate Lynn Wood is currently living in a home in a town in that town as her primary residence, according to a determination from the Summit County Assessor's Office. That announcement dispels allegations that Wood was not a resident of Colville, is not a resident of Colville, I should say, and further that she claims two different primary homes, one in Summit County and one in Salt Lake. Rick Bruff has more on that.
Wood is running against Mark Marsh for the Colville mayor seat on the general election ballot coming up in about 2 months. County Assessor Stephanie Paul told us that in July, her office asked Wood and her husband to submit an application for primary home status. Paul said her department is beginning a new policy of occasional audits, and her action didn't have anything to do with the city's elections.
But it had nothing to do with that, just a periodic audit, and we found that the application that was on file was extremely old, and so we did send it out, particularly after we found out that she does have another home that they own in the Salt Lake County. We just sent out an application. They have filled that out. They've provided the necessary proof of residency. And so we have applied that exemption in Colville, and then we do let Salt Lake County know that the exemption is being applied here, and they'll make any necessary changes, if any, needed in their county.
Paul reported that Wood and her husband have been primary home residents since September 1st of last year. Candidates for mayor in Colville must live in town for 12 months before election day. Under Utah law, the owner of a primary home is only charged 50% of their property tax rate. Secondary homeowner must pay 100%. As KPCW previously reported, Wood said in recent years she and her husband lived full-time at their home in Sandy because her husband faced medical challenges and needed to be closer to a Salt Lake hospital. She said they moved back to Colville when her husband's health allowed it. Lynn Wood owns another home in Colville. County Assessor Paul said that is taxed as a secondary home. She added that the Salt Lake home could be taxed as a primary home if it is occupied by a long-term renter. For KVCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, joining me now on the line, we have Summit County Development Director Pat Putt with an update on development projects throughout the county and anything else we care to ask him. Good morning, Pat. How are you?
Good morning, Sean. It's nice to talk to you today.
For sure. So as usual, what new developments have come through the door at Summit County since we last spoke with you?
Well, over the course of the last couple weeks, we haven't had any major or significant projects. And I guess what I would mean by that, new large subdivisions, new large commercial projects, new applications in and around the canyons, none of them of that nature. But we continue to get a lot of sort of the administrative application things, requests to amend subdivision plats, move building pads, adjust lot lines, some low impact permits. So it's been quiet on the major project application front, but I have a strong sense that next month when we talk, we may have several items to talk about. And I base that just fundamentally on pre-application discussions that we are having at a staff level with property owners, developers who are looking into applying for projects. None that I can probably speak about today, but I have a feeling there'll be a couple of them coming up here in the next month. So I look forward to having those conversations in early October.
Can you give us an idea of where some of those projects might be located if you can't talk specifics?
They are across the county, several on the east side, several in the basin. When you look at the activity that's going around, it's really happening countywide. So they're all over.
Sounds like you'll be a busy man next time we talk.
I think we're going to be real busy moving into the to the fall and the winter, usually, you know, we hit, used to be a day or a time when we would hit, say, mid-October, and things would slow up a little bit. I'm here to tell you those days seem to be gone, at least for the near-term foreseeable future. We're pretty busy, and the building department remains on, I would probably say, an unprecedented level of activity on all sides. New residential development, you know, infills of, you know, vacant lots, remodels of existing single family homes. The Canyons remains very, very busy. I don't think that there isn't a neighborhood in the Snyderville Basin in particular that isn't under some form of, you know, Traco impact. Tip my cap to my colleagues over in the building department. They're stretched, they're working hard, but they seem to be able to stay on top of it.
And we've heard a lot and reported on some of the stories about material shortages. I know a lot was made about lumber earlier in the year, certainly labor shortages now, and you're saying that even with those shortages, construction and development is still through the roof.
It is. We're very, very busy. We're well beyond when our unit stats report came in for the end of August. We were well beyond our numbers for last year at the end of the year. We continue to stay really busy. It would be an interesting conversation for you to have with some folks like our colleagues over at the Park City Home Builders Association. But anecdotally, several of the larger contractors are saying they are booked out several years. They're that busy. And we're sort of on the processing end of that.
Wow. That is incredible. So last time you were here, you said that you would have some more information about a proposed guest ranch in Browns Canyon. Has there been any movement on that front since we last talked?
No. I think our staff planners are continuing to work on that, but I don't have any additional information to report on that, and I don't believe, I'd have to go back, but I don't believe we currently have that scheduled as of yet.
Gotcha. So what's on the agenda for the Snyderville Planning Commission coming up? Anything we should keep our eye on?
So Tuesday night, September 14, the Planning Commission is going to take a look at a couple of, remember just before I was talking about, you know, a lot of requests to modify subdivisions, whether they're building pads or lot lines or condominiumize existing projects. That's what we're going to be doing on Tuesday night. We had a couple projects that we were looking to bring to some public hearings, but a couple of those have fallen off the agenda, not quite ready to go to the commission. So the two that we have left are in the basin. One is going to be, the commission's going to be looking at a request to approve a condominium plat in the Canyons for the Yotel iPad project that's been under construction now for a couple of years, a major lodging facility there. So this is sort of the final step before the project is completed through a certificate of occupancy. This will allow, when the project's done, to be able to sell off those individual units. And I think the project is a fairly large one. It's about 144 individual units. So the commission will be taking a look at that one. The other is going to be for a piece of property out on Forestdale Drive. And Forestdale Drive is out on the old US 40 frontage road. If you're coming from Park City saying you're going to go to Home Depot, that's that service commercial live work space, those projects out on the east side of the highway. And we have a request from a property owner to subdivide a property, one unit into two units. So the Planning Commission will be taking a look at that request. Both of those are going to be scheduled for, the Forestdale Drive is actually a public hearing. The Yotel, that isn't a public hearing. That'll just be a recommendation to the county manager, Tom Fisher. There'll be a public hearing once that gets to his level. So a rather light agenda, but I plan to use, you know, that flex time we have in the meeting to update the Planning Commission sort of on some upcoming workload items that we're going to be bringing to them. One of the requests from the County Council, as the Planning Commission works through its general plan discussion, is they'd like feedback from the Commission specifically on two things. Number one, General Plan Policy 2.3, and that's the policy in the general plan that says basically that the county isn't going to approve any new rezonings or increases in development that, you know, exist already, that are already entitled, in situations where they want to ask for more, unless there's some community benefit associated, some countervailing public interest. And since that policy was put in place, you know, those countervailing public interests were things like workforce housing or significant transportation, transit, construction, you know, sticks and mortar improvements. I think the council's looking to see what the Planning Commission's thoughts on that. Should the language stay the same? Should that provision, that unless there's a countervailing public interest, should that remain? Should it be stricken? Are there other community benefits beyond housing and transit transportation that, you know, the county should possibly consider as part of a possible zone change or renegotiation of an existing development permit? So that's going to be a real important item coming up. We're not going to talk about it Tuesday, but I'm just going to kind of set the stage for that conversation. The other is the council has asked the Planning Commission to take a look at the general plan's future land use map. It's an important piece of the general plan. It's not a zoning map, but, you know, it is that first step, that indicator, that first filter that is used as a tool to consider possible rezonings. And why that's important to the council, and rightly so, not long ago, the council adopted a brand new zoning district, a neighborhood mixed-use zone. The existing future land use map identifies several areas in the basin wherein that rezoning might be considered. Doesn't mean it will be. And I think the council, now that they have the new zone, wants to make sure that that future land use map, particularly in those mixed use areas, are consistent with the community values, you know, the commission sort of look into the future on where these potential areas might be located. Do we need to shrink some of them? Do we need to eliminate some of them? Do we need to expand, in certain cases, some of those areas? And that's what they're going to be asked to take a look at. And in some cases, it's going to be, you know, possibly a combination of maybe all of those three. So that's going to be important. That's going to be our Tuesday night. So short agenda, but there's going to be a fair amount of conversation going on.
Short.
Certainly, we'll be busy in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, short and dense next week is what it sounds like.
Short and dense. Well said.
So what we've heard a lot about what's called ornamental grass. Those little medians along the highway that are in covered in grass, or parking lots in commercial centers. Will the Planning Commission and Council be moving towards any kind of regulation on that, given the drought conditions over the past few years?
We're going to be coming back with another work session here. The objective is to come back for the second meeting in September and continue the conversation on some draft amendment work that we're doing basin-wide for landscaping. We had an initial conversation, I think, the last meeting. We got some good feedback. The draft that we took by no means represented the final product. It really was a framework, an outline that, with the help of the commission initially and then with the feedback of the public, that the overall objective is to bring our landscaping up to a level that will address our water situation moving into the future. And so, you know, among some of those topics of discussion were, you know, the type of irrigation systems that we should be considering. You know, a lot of people are saying, you know, do we eliminate spray irrigation? You know, the typical things that most people would have in their lawns. Do we go simply to a drip system? No decisions have been made at that point. But what we're trying to achieve through this is a code that's more predictable, easier to use, creates an expectation up front for both, you know, property owners, our landscape designers, our landscaping firms. And the idea is to the best that we can as a community, be more efficient on how we water our homes and our businesses and our HOA projects. I think there's some fear out there that, you know, the ordinance is going to be such that there will be mandates that existing lawns will be, you know, required to be torn out and, you know, green river rock brought in. That's certainly not the case. We have a fairly robust code when it comes to commercial and multifamily projects. It's just silent to single family. And so we're trying to find that middle ground. You know, one of the tools that we're going to be using is Utah State University has a specific recommended plant list for Summit County. Our growing zone, our plant zone is unique up here in sort of the high desert. And so we're going to be linking, you know, those recommendations into the code. Is it going to ultimately require, you know, people to remove all their existing turf and, you know, look like something that, you know, out of, you know, the Maricopa County, Phoenix area? We don't believe so. And I think there's really good examples. There's precedents out in the community right now of what works in terms of low water use landscaping. In terms of, you know, Sean, you mentioned the islands in between, you know, the streets and the roads. There's real good examples in existence as you're in the 224 coming into Park City. A number of our larger residential neighborhoods have begun to understand this. I don't mean to spotlight, you know, one in particular, but I will. Promontory, through their HOA and their design guidelines, have developed what I think is a very viable low water use landscaping irrigation plan that they use inside sort of their public rights of way and their public facilities. And it's a combination of both drip low water use irrigation systems and an idealized kind of plant list. There's a lot of native grasses and plants that thrive under a low water use environment that are actually quite colorful, and those colors change throughout the seasons. And so, you know, we're going to hopefully be using examples such as that. So at the end, what this will be, if we're going to be successful managing our water going into the future, it's going to take a lot of help and a lot of lifting. It's going to involve the water providers. It's going to involve help from the HOAs. It's going to require some code expectation on the county's part. But really, it's going to require, I think, an understanding and to an agree and embracing by individual homeowners and property owners that, you know, part of our, you know, Summit County, Park City areas, you know, Eastern Summit County area, union card holding requirements is we need to be responsible stewards for how we water. And part of that may make change. And the idea is to set some expectation now. And as we move forward, you know, incentivize people to make the existing changes in their existing yards, but for new construction, start from day one. So we think we can get there.
Yeah, sounds very interesting. Real quick, before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you about the concept of smart growth, and that's a development philosophy that thinks new development should be geared towards walkable neighborhoods, compact building design, a strong sense of place. How hard is something like that to accomplish in Summit County? Obviously, everything's a lot spread out. Utah's a very pro-development state. Is that something Summit County has an eye on?
Yeah. Yes, we do, to be real precise. You know, smart growth seems to be, in a lot of people's minds, something that just was conjured up here in the last decade or so. But, you know, really what smart growth is going back to a fundamental way of building the places where we live, our towns, like we did basically from the end of the Pleistocene up until about 1945. You know, you look back historically, even just locally here, if you go back and look historically at places like Park City or Colville or Camas or Oakley or Salt Lake or Santa Fe, all of those communities were built with those principles, Sean, that you just spoke of. And I think long term, as we head into the future in the next generation, our success as community will be to a large degree based on our ability to learn from our ancestors' ways of building towns and neighborhoods and communities, and try, where reasonable and possible, to build off some of those basic principles. And I think there's a fear, I understand it and I get it, that somewhere in the back room of, you know, the courthouse or, you know, maybe the, you know, the Marsac building, that, you know, the planners are in their white lab coats and they're trying to figure out a scheme to go into Silver Springs or, you know, Jeremy Ranch or where I live out in Trailside, and all of a sudden, you know, drop some McUrbanism project inside their neighborhood. No, that's really not the case. I think what we are attempting to do, as well as our colleagues in Park City, and frankly, I've had conversations with folks who are over on the east side communities. Really what we're attempting to do is realize that if we're gonna manage the growth that will be coming in the future, those basic principles of being able to be efficient in our design, you know, people, whether you call it clustering or being compact in the design, that results in efficient infrastructure, whether that's pipe, sewer pipe, streets that have to be maintained, how we use it. It's going to be really, really important. That idea, you know, that smart growth idea talks about always having sort of a range of housing opportunities. You know, I haven't talked to anybody who personally said that we should target our residential product to one specific user group. Most people, you know, like the idea where it's reasonable. Can we have cradle to grave opportunities? You know, can we have housing opportunities for people who are just starting out in life? Can we have housing opportunities when they start growing a family? Can we have housing opportunities when those kids leave and we begin to downsize? Can we grow old and not necessarily be exiled into a Del Webb project down in Maricopa County or in Ivins? Can we stay in our community? Those are the things that smart growth is really all about.
Yeah.
And those are the conversations that I think we're having. And I think what we're trying to do is target the areas where we have redevelopment opportunities and look if there are attributes of smart growth that we can apply in those areas. Now, that said, if we can connect our existing residential neighborhoods into these areas where people don't always have to get into a car, they choose not to, can we create the infrastructure to help them move in ways that isn't always motorized? And we embrace that in Summit County, and that's what we hope the future will continue to look like, is utilizing those tools where reasonable.
Yeah, sounds like a lot to think about. Pat, I've run out of time. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure, as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Sean. Talk to you soon.
Well, a new show is coming to KPCW. Rich Tone's Curated Jazz premieres tonight at 10 p.m. and is hosted by Parkite and jazz aficionado Rich Rector. The program will run on both Friday and Saturday nights and will feature music from jazz legends and emerging new artists. It also shares information about the motivations behind the music, as well as interesting facts about the various artists. Whether you're a longtime lover of jazz or a new listener, this show is not to be missed. I spoke with Rich yesterday about his new show and his love for jazz. Rich, thank you so much for joining us. My first question, why jazz? What makes jazz so special?
You know, that's a good question. I think that we might even ask our listeners to help us define what they think jazz is. But to me, it's really about an expression. It's a way that musicians actually speak a different language. You have musicians from all over the world who can actually speak the same language through their music. And to me, that communication is what jazz is all about.
And I understand music has been a part of your life for almost your entire life. Your father was in a swing band. What formal music training do you have? And then how does that kind of flavor what you're going to be bringing to this show?
You know, it's funny. I'm not really a musician, although I, you know, grew up in the grade school band playing clarinet, and my brother played saxophone, but I really, you know, it was the marching band and those band concerts at, you know, grade school that are somewhat painful. But then I took up the guitar and I started playing in a couple of little garage bands, you know, in high school. And but that was, you know, rock and roll and folk guitar, that kind of thing. But I never really played any jazz. I started listening to, actually years and years ago, Steve Allen had a radio show late at night when I was in high school, and he started talking about jazz. And then I went to college, and my roommate there was a jazz saxophone player, and he taught me a lot. We would listen to the radio in the Bay Area. It was the original K-Jazz, K-J-A-Z. And they would play an amazing amount of music, and he would, you know, help me learn who was playing what.
I listened to your promo you recorded for us at KPCW, and you even talked about your freshman roommate in college would give you these blindfold tests where he'd play you a piece of music and ask you who the musician was. How long That's did right. it take you to figure those things out? Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, well, it's interesting. You know, some players are very distinctive, and so it didn't take too long, say, for learning how to hear Maynard Ferguson, who is a trumpet player that is known for hitting the highest notes you can imagine. So that was pretty easy to, you know, to figure out. Chick Corea's piano playing also was fairly distinctive. So there were just a few people like that. But after a while, you would start, you know, just picking up sort of nuances. But and that would take some time. It still does. But this was something that came out of Downbeat magazine years ago. They would always, on the back page, they'd always do a blindfold test with some famous musician, and they would play, you know, cuts of music for them that maybe they had heard, maybe they hadn't heard. And that's how, you know, we started to kind of emulate that.
And so talking about this show in specifically Curated Jazz, what can people expect out of this first episode? I was looking through the artist list, some famous names on there that a lot of people I think will recognize, John Coltrane, and a lot of names people maybe won't expect to hear. What can we expect out of episode one?
Well, my goal really is to give a sort of a smorgasbord of music in the first show, for people to just kind of, you know, hear examples of things that might pop up. There's no particular theme to the first show, but I plan on doing themes in future shows. So, yeah, I mean, there are definitely some famous names. I try to do a new release maybe on each show. So there's something that's brand new as well as some of the old classics. And then I've got a show coming up. I think it's our third show that I call Jazzy Beatles, maybe the fourth show. But anyway, it's a whole bunch of very familiar Beatles songs that you'll recognize the melodies and everything, but they're done by jazz artists in ways that you've never heard before. So, you know, that's a nice theme show. Just trying to reach out to people that maybe, you know, are intimidated a little bit by jazz because it is, you know, there's something known as the jazz snobs, sort of like wine snobs, you know. It's like, you know, when it comes to wine tasting, people can get a little snooty about it, but it really comes down to what you like and what you don't like. And jazz is the same way. You know, there are a lot of people that, you know, don't like Kenny G, you know, it's like, you know, light jazz or whatever. And then there's the purists that have to, you know, get deep into the John Coltrane saxophone solos. So, you know, it's just a wide variety of things.
It's interesting you bring that up because I saw a really interesting quote by Miles Davis. He said, "You should never be comfortable with jazz." And it almost sounds like this show is kind of turning that quote on its head and trying to make it a welcoming place for anybody, even for people who have never even heard jazz before.
Well, that's true. And I would like to make jazz a little more approachable for people. You bring up Miles. He's one of my heroes. And I actually got to see him twice playing live. And he was one of the most interesting characters around and probably influenced the most other jazz musicians, I think. It's amazing. I'm thinking about doing a show of what I'm calling a Miles family tree and highlighting some of the other players that he used to play with.
I remember way back when I was in college, I took the history of jazz. And I remember my professor talking about how it's the distinct American music. You can trace it back all the way to the days with black slaves in the fields in the South picking cotton, trying to sing songs. It evolved into the blues, and then you have the jazz. Can you talk a little bit about how jazz has its fingerprints on all the different types of music there are these days?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If you go back to New Orleans area, that was really kind of the first American jazz. In fact, it used to be called jazz, J-A-S-S. I don't know how it morphed into jazz, but basically you had different styles popping up. You had, obviously, you know, the Dixieland things coming out of New Orleans, but then you go to Chicago and Kansas City and you started hearing all these different styles coming out, bebop in Kansas City. So, you know, it really evolved over a period of time, but when you think about the origins, it really had to do with emotions. And, you know, that was kind of the whole idea of the improvisations. You had the slaves out picking cotton, you know, singing and almost, you know, rapping and the percussions and all that. And it was really improvisation. And I think that's what the roots of jazz really are.
I understand this is going to be a twice weekly show, Friday at 10 p.m., Saturday at 11 p.m. Are those going to be different or rebroadcast on Saturday? Are those going to be two separate shows?
It's a rebroadcast on Saturday of the Friday show. So there'll be 52 shows, one a week, but replayed on Saturday.
And then where do you want to take this? Where do you see curated jazz going over the next year?
Well, you know, I would like to get listener input. Hopefully we'll get some feedback from people. Unfortunately, we can't podcast the shows because of licensing issues and royalty issues and things like that. You know, the station's licensing takes care of all that for the broadcast. But if we put it back up on a Facebook page or on the website, we can't replay it. So my goal there is to put up some links that would maybe help people see some other, well, maybe even just photographs of the artists, possibly links of some other public things like on YouTube that can be played for people to maybe expand a little more on what they heard on my show.
How can people contact you and give this feedback?
The best way to do it is just to email me. It's rich@kpcw.org. You know, rich@kpcw.org, and then that's the best way to do it.
Anything else you want to share with us before your first show?
Well, I really am excited to, like I say, get the feedback. I really don't know what audience we're going to have there in Park City, but Park City is such an international city when you think about all the people that come in for Olympic training and just, you know, people from all over the world. So I think that jazz, you know, really is something that is listened to maybe more in other countries than the U.S. sometimes. So I think it'll be interesting to hear. Now, of course, the airtime is a little late on Fridays and Saturdays, so I'm not sure exactly what audience we're going to have, but I'm really excited to try something new, and hopefully people will enjoy it.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck. We'll all be listening.
Thank you, Sean.
Rich Tone's curated jazz premieres tonight at 10 p.m. right here on KPCW. Catch the show every Friday at 10 p.m. and every Saturday at 11 p.m. You're listening to the Local News Hour. We'll be right back with more. Well, the Wasatch County Health District Health Promotion Director Janelle Fitzgerald gave both a COVID-19 update and an annual report at the most recent Wasatch County Council meeting last week. Joining us now to talk about that update and the latest on COVID-19 in Wasatch County is Wasatch County Health Department PIO and epidemiologist Chris Smoot. Chris, good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we heard Janelle tell us the other day that new cases have remained relatively consistent between early and late August updates, but the focus right now is on school outbreaks and child hospitalizations, especially with RSV present right now. For people who aren't familiar with RSV, who gets it, what is it, and can you put into context the challenge of a surge in RSV cases now demanding hospital resources?
Sure. So RSV, it stands for respiratory syncytial virus, but it's easier just to say RSV. It's a common respiratory illness that we see every year. It's been out there for a long time. New parents might be familiar with it, talking to their pediatrician or even in the hospitals if you're giving birth in the wintertime. So it's, like I said, it's a common respiratory illness that we see every year, characterized by cough, fever, runny nose, just kind of those typical symptoms from a cold. What's unusual this year is typically we see it surge or you know, pick up in the winter months or even the early spring. But this year we've seen a real increase, not just here on the Wasatch Back, but throughout the state of Utah. About since the start of July, it's picked up quite a bit and surged quite a bit. So as far as who's affected most by it, anyone can get it, but typically it's going to be those younger kids or even our older adults who don't have as robust of immune systems, who could maybe develop complications or have a more severe case requiring, you know, some medical care. And so that complication is probably twofold. One, the symptoms are very similar to COVID symptoms, and so parents may not know, or a person may not know, do I have RSV or do I have COVID or do I have some other respiratory illness? And so it can cause confusion that way. But as far as the medical capacity or healthcare capacity, what we've seen is with this surge in cases this summer or the end of summer, start of fall, that's led to several children, I guess, needing to be seen in hospitals and even specifically like primary children's hospital. They've seen an increase in kids with RSV there. So I suppose when we're talking COVID, the problem that causes is just it's one more potential strain on the healthcare system and the confusion that it may cause since it's so similar in symptoms.
Right. And then speaking of hospitalizations, we've heard a lot of news, particularly statewide, about the strain on hospitals and ICUs right now. What are the situations in local Wasatch County General and children's hospitals right now, and any referral hospitals the area uses as it comes to ICU and COVID-19 load?
So fortunately, unfortunately, we have seen hospitalizations, but fortunately right now, we don't have any Wasatch County residents hospitalized with COVID-19, which is a good thing. We're glad for that. But that's unfortunately not the case for the rest of the state. There are several people hospitalized right now. I'm going to pull up my data right now. It looks like currently there are about over 500 people hospitalized statewide. And the number of those in the ICU are just under 200. So how that translates to rates, if we look at all the ICU beds in the state, 88% are full, which is maybe a little higher than normal. They usually run at fairly high capacity. And the unusual part here is about 35% of the hospital beds have COVID patients in them. So here locally, I don't believe we have anyone at Heber Valley Hospital that's inpatient, at least not a Wasatch County resident. At Park City Hospital, I'm not sure. I don't keep track of their data quite as closely. As far as children's hospitals, really the only children's hospital here in the region is Primary Children's, and I don't know exactly how many cases they have. But I did hear from them about a week or so ago that, yeah, with the RSV surge and a few other respiratory illnesses that are out there, adding COVID on top of that, they are fairly full and a little bit stressed for resources. Not entirely up to COVID, other causes too, but having a surge in COVID cases certainly doesn't help that.
Right, and the most dominant strain right now in the United States and in Utah is this Delta variant, highly contagious from what we hear. How effective is Delta at spreading from, say, an unvaccinated person to a vaccinated person and vice versa, and what about two vaccinated people?
So I don't have exact data on that, unfortunately. I'm sorry, I haven't been able to track that down. But if you go on CDC's website, they actually have a page specific with Delta variant, and it talks about how in vaccinated people with other strains, usually the viral load, if they end up getting sick, the viral load will be much lower than in an unvaccinated person. However, with Delta variant, it looks like the viral load is pretty much the same in a vaccinated person versus an unvaccinated person. Which, yeah, we're talking about infected people, not just the general public, right? So it's interesting that it seems like there may be a similar chance of spreading it, whether you're vaccinated or not. What the vaccine's doing is helping people who get infected not be as severely infected. But unfortunately, it looks like they still can spread it.
Right. And speaking a little bit more of vaccinations, I know there's been a big push to get younger people vaccinated. We're very good at vaccinating the elderly and most at risk of the population. How is Wasatch County doing, particularly in that, I guess, under 40 age category?
I think we're doing all right. If you look at our numbers versus state numbers, we're in the top third, I believe, of the health districts and counties as far as vaccination rates. Still room to grow, but we understand this is a very personal decision, and we want people to make educated decisions regarding their health. We do recommend vaccination, but we understand people should have that chance to consult with their healthcare provider and make the best choice for them. But if you look at our rates, right now, the most recent data I have is our lowest rates at this point are in the 12 to 18 year olds, and they're at about 53% have received at least one dose of vaccine, and then it just goes up from there. So the 19 to 29 year olds, it's about 57%. The 30 to 39 year olds, it's just over 61%, and it grows from there. So it seems like the trend is as people get older, they're maybe more interested or able or willing to get the vaccine.
Right, and do you have anything to share about any upcoming booster shot recommendations and availability? I know there's been a lot of talk about that in particular parts of the country and certainly in the national media.
Well, we are. We're preparing for what seems like an inevitability of getting approval for a booster dose. Right now, the only thing that's approved is what's considered an additional dose for immunocompromised people. So those on transplant or a few different immunocompromised situations, such as some types of treatment and whatnot that really suppresses the immune system. So they can come in and get an additional shot right now. They don't need to wait, and there's no time delay between their last dose and this additional dose. However, with the booster, what that means is just, again, giving a boost to your immune system. Just as immunity sometimes can wane a little bit over time, we want to get a booster just to recharge our immune system. So our current outlook or guidance, which we all know is subject to change, but what it's looking like is the booster is going to be eligible for people 8 months after their final dose. So say you finished your vaccine series back in February, then you'd be eligible for this booster coming up in October. So there's going to be a bit of a time gap there, unless that changes, which we've heard maybe it'll change to 6 months. We don't know at this point until it gets the approval. But in preparation for that, we are making sure that we have enough vaccine on hand, and we will make it as convenient and easy as possible for all those who want to get that booster. We're currently planning for making available in our clinics, as well as the potential for some drive-through clinics like we had in the winter and spring to make it as convenient as possible. The advantage here too is where when the vaccine first came out, we were one of the few providers in the community, especially in Wasatch County, to be able to give the vaccine. This time around, there are a lot more pharmacies that have it available, and so there's a lot more flexibility and choice, so people can do it on their own terms and own time.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to add before we run out of time this morning?
About COVID? Or
just about COVID or any other updates from the health department you want to touch on?
Just appreciate the chance to come on here, and we just encourage people to take, you know, basic steps. COVID or not, if you're sick, stay home, right? Like we said with RSV and some other things that are out there, we don't want those spreading either. So just wash your hands, stay home when you're sick, and yeah, just do your part. And one thing I will say, if people are interested in keeping up with what else is going on out there, Intermountain Healthcare has a great resource. Just look up GermWatch on the internet, and that is a great resource to see what other germs are out there based on what Intermountain's seeing in their InstaCares clinics and hospitals. So okay, it's a great resource. And then for further information on local COVID data, you can visit us at coronavirus.wasatch.utah.gov.
Wonderful. Chris, thank you so much. I got to leave it there. That's Chris Smoot with the Wasatch County Health Department. Thank you.